Well, that was really weird. I couldn't seem to set a time stamp on this one. Very, very strange. Well, anyway, here we go, I guess. Welcome to Strange Days. Into the folder of choice. All right, let's zoom down here. Well, this is getting around a bit today, is that the royal family cues British media for a major announcement at any moment. According to the reports, the BBC events production unit has been notified to keep an eye out for a major announcement from the royal family in the wake of current health crisis. Wonder if it's got anything to do with the doctoring of Meghan. Let's have a quick look at the October 7th fiasco that happened there. What's going on here?
And that Iran is not actually
making. Hey, welcome to the room.
Again, this is from the CIA, NSA, FBI, all confirming this part of the annual threat assessment report. They come together and they provide this. The report also shows that the U.S. knows that supporting Israel will make us less safe in the United States, and it will cost American lives. Here you go, Mr. President. Here's the report on your desk this morning. It shows that Iran didn't know anything about October 7th, and I know you're planning on bombing them.
Hey, Robert, good to see you.
And also going to kill Americans. Have a good day. Now, what do you do with it, Mr. Biden? Do you do a State of the Union address where you then double down on going to war with Iran? Of course you do. That's probably what you do. So why are we doing all of this? Why are we meddling in the Middle East? Why are we throwing so much money and weapons and putting warships in the Red Sea and in the Middle East when it's absolutely not in our best interest?
Right. War is a virtuous circle. You put it out there, it comes right back. It's a boomerang. So let's take a look at it. This is the annual threat assessment from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Our own security acknowledged this about Netanyahu, that he's a dangerous leader who could be the death of us all. They say his visibility as leader, as well as his governing coalition of far-right and ultra-Orthodox parties that pursued hardline policies on Palestinian and security issues, may be in jeopardy. You think? Distrust of Netanyahu's ability to rule has deepened and broadened across the public from its already high levels before the war, and we expect large protests demanding his resignation and new elections. A different, more moderate government is a possibility.
So Netanyahu can't be trusted, and he's about to be thrown out.
He's an extremist? He's dangerous?
This is from the U.S. Intel community.
What is his hardline policies they're talking about? Well, his hardline is never will we allow the Palestinians to have a state. Period. That's what they mean, hardline. So how do these people exist? Either dead, that's how they exist, or in a continued state of oppression. That's
or
the hard...
ethnically cleansed completely out of Palestine into Egypt, into Syria, into tent camps, and so forth.
Oh, okay, dispersed.
Dispersed, right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, how does it happen that this, so this is the U.S. intelligence agencies writing this, how is it that doesn't trickle down then into maybe stop sending weapons to this person?
Great question.
Like, it seems to me that's a no-brainer. Like, hey, we think this guy's a really, really dangerous guy. Maybe stop sending him weapons.
Our intelligence agencies are telling us that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, right? So we need to go. So maybe they're getting it totally wrong. Who knows? But, right, like, we use this all the time as a reason, as a catalyst for these things. Because we don't have access to it, right? We don't get to see it often. But here we actually literally have this threat assessment. Jody Brown in the chat says, I heard a little half-second clip of this on our local news this morning and thought to myself, this will get silenced immediately. Thanks for covering
yes.
this. Thanks for covering this, Redacted. Bravo. Thank you, Jody. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is from Redacted with Clayton Morris. It goes for too long, so I'm only going to play about another 4 minutes of it, 3.5 minutes. But it gives you a bit of a perspective on this situation here, I think, a little bit of a deeper dive.
So this is why they don't want you to know about it. They love war. They want us to go to war.
Well, think about it, because the reason we go after Iran so much is because we say they support terrorists, therefore they cannot have nuclear weapons. But this is basically saying that Netanyahu is a dangerous extremist. He can have some nukes, though. It's okay. He gets a few strawberries. Now, the report also says that Hezbollah is calibrating on how to respond. That's a direct quote, calibrating. So they're figuring it out. Now, Hezbollah, I'd like to remind you, was formed with the sole purpose of liberating Muslims from the oppression of Israel, and more specifically was a response to Israel invading Lebanon in 1982. That is why they call them anti-Semitic. It is not an anti-Semitic organization. It is an anti-Zionist organization completely, although they do hold all Jewish citizens, all Israeli citizens and Jewish people accountable for the Zionist government, which is clearly problematic, right? You can't say that collective punishment is wrong if it is okay for the Jews. It has to be, you can't say Palestinians don't deserve collective punishment for their government if you believe Jewish people do. You can't have it both ways. So I'm not defending Hezbollah here, right? I'm reminding you that there are, how do you say this, raison d'etre?
Like your raison d'etre?
Yeah. Your reason for being
right.
is to end the oppression of Muslims from the Zionist government. Nevertheless, Hezbollah, according to this report, will collaborate with Iran to stop Israel from the attack on Gaza. And since they know that they would not win an all-out war against Israel, what will they do? Attack Americans, according to this report. They're saying in Iraq, Iranian-aligned militias almost certainly will continue attacks against U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria.
So you can either look at this, you could look at this one way, is like, get the F out of there now. You know that they're going to attack and kill American soldiers. Why are you there in these illegal bases? Iraq doesn't want us there. I thought we left Iraq. No, we've added another base recently. So they're going to be attacked and they're going to be killed. American soldiers are going to be just like they were in Yemen. Again, this is going to continue to happen, and President Biden knows it. So you can use this and say, get them out now, if you're a smart leader, or you can keep them out there like lambs to the slaughter.
Yeah, it's sort of working on the verge of a jihad, what they call the old jihad, sort of the holy war, you know, a righteous indignation of them and just saying enough's enough and... Yeah, one big slaughterhouse, I guess. It's one big possibility of how things could go. Sadly to say. I'm just trying to see which one I've got lined up here. Oh, yep, played that one before, actually. Got a couple of things here.
I sent my pet lizard DNA into 23.
Listen to this guy. I remember this. I just come across it again the other day. He sent his pet lizard a sample of his pet 23andMe. And check out the DNA of this.
And so with the help of my wife, we extracted enough saliva to send off in the mail. We were so excited to see the results. After about 3 months... we were shocked. My lizard was 51% Ashkenazi Jewish. He was also 48% West Asian. This was really interesting. They also gave us a little bit of his background and his history, what he liked to eat, etc. Let us know which animal DNA we should send in next.
Bloody hell. I'd send a rat in, see what the hell that brings back. That'd be fascinating.
Charles come from the Orsini family. Roth means red in German, and the Orsini means red, red bear, little red bears. That's what Orsini means. The Grey Pope is Pepe Orsini. He trumps the black, he trumps the white Pope.
The Grey Pope is great even pope. Higher than the black and the white Pope.
The Orsini is the Maxima family. They are the maximum family. They are on top. And somehow they've trumped the Colonna and the Farnese, which I know without any doubt through all my studies that they are the three most powerful Illuminati.
What about Rothschild and Rockefeller?
Well, they are Orsini. They just changed their name. Rockefeller were Rothschilds. Rothschilds were Orsini. Orsini were a family which have their lines in Babylon and Egypt. They tell you that. You read their biographies, they'll tell you that. We go back to Nimrod. They tell you that. The Rothschilds say that. We go back to Nimrod. How? Through the Orsini. So Rockefeller, Rothschild, Orsini, and then you go back to the Persian and Egyptian dynasties.
There you go, guys.
The future. Could it actually happen with a real time machine?
Let's talk about time travel. Let's go a little dig into this. I'm going to play it for 25 minutes. That's right.
I was devastated. I thought if I could build a time machine that I could go back and see him again and tell him what was going to happen, maybe save his life. And so that became an obsession for me.
Time travel has captivated people for centuries. The thought of journeying through time, whether to revisit the past or glimpse into the future, ignites curiosity and sparks the imagination. This fascination with time travel predates modern blockbusters like Interstellar and Marvel movies. While some question its feasibility, there are intriguing stories of individuals claiming to have experienced it firsthand.
Actually, because it's so long, I'm actually going to publish this one next. Yeah, I'll bookmark that and I'll put it as a broadcast. Yeah. Hey, welcome to the room, mate. Yeah, we're going to go into time travel, but I'll play you a bit of a taste of it anyway for 5 minutes. I think you'll find this fascinating, and I'll publish the whole episode. It goes for about half an hour. Hey, welcome.
For instance, two reporters allegedly witnessed a significant news event before it actually occurred. Could time travel truly exist? Join us as we reveal the truth about time machines, the man behind the infamous time machine. In early 1995, Mike Markham, a 21-year-old
Mike,
student of electrical engineering living in Stanbury, Missouri, started working on building a time machine.
Check this out.
His goal was to get rich by going to the future and getting winning lottery numbers. He was said to have lacked formal training. The back porch of his house, where he did most of his experiments, was very messy and looked like a home appliance graveyard with parts of old TVs, radios, and CDs strewn all over the place. Mike had been playing around with a device called Jacob's Ladder when he noticed something strange. Mike was tinkering with Jacob's Ladder, which he had modified. It had a home-built electronic transformer.
You check this out. This is a transformer, all right, and this is what he's done. It's an amazing story. This is massive, massive scale, man. I mean, this is bigger than a community's.
With a power of 20,000 volts.
20,000.
Mike had to create this transformer because the standard household voltage in the U.S. is 120 to 240 volts. For the conductors in Jacob's Ladder, Mike used wire hangers as well as lasers to heat the air around the conductor to take care of air pressure and temperature changes, which could ruin the experiment. While working with the device, Mike claimed to have seen a circular vortex that was 8 inches across. He figured he would test the effect by repeatedly throwing in a sheet metal screw to see what would happen. According to Mike, every time he threw it in, the screw disappeared and reappeared a few feet away a second later. The metal screw, in his opinion, had been transported through time, reappearing when time had caught up. Seeing what had happened with this experiment, Mike was determined to go the extra mile. He was going to build a time machine that would be 8 feet instead of the 8-inch Jacob's Ladder he had used for the initial experiment.
but Mike had an enormous challenge ahead of him. He required a lot of power to advance his research to the point where they could work for humans. Furthermore, while he was scaling up his work on the so-called time machine, the device caught fire. Undeterred, Mike reasoned that using bigger transformers to produce higher voltages would be more sensible if he were to rebuild the machine. But that would set him back around $20,000 per transformer. So he decided to break into a local power plant and steal 6 old transformers.
Check that out. He actually broke in to build his time machine. It's fascinating.
To continue his work. However, once he attached the transformers to Jacob's ladder, he sparked a massive blackout on the streets in his neighborhood, shutting down the electrical grid for several hours. Soon after, police arrived at his home with a warrant to search it and took him into custody for stealing the transformers. Mike reportedly admitted to the judge during his trial that he was attempting to find the lottery-winning numbers so that he could raise money for a research facility. After being released from prison a few months later, Mike became well known on local radio by sharing tales of the missing screw and his ambition to create a time machine. The radio show in question, Art Bell's Radio Show, frequently touched on paranormal topics. Mike was quickly labeled a madman by the host, Art, and he happily took up the moniker.
The strange tale
of Madman Mike is documented on the radio station's website. While on air, Mike informed Art and his audience that he was out of money and spare parts to carry out his research. He even went so far as to broadcast his phone number live, after which he supposedly received non-stop calls for the following 3 days. His next time machine invention was more ambitious and powerful than the first, thanks to donations from his listeners. He intended to use the device on himself to test it by producing an electromagnetic vortex large enough for a person to walk through. A year later, when he returned to the radio show, Mike was asked what he would bring along in his time travel journey. He indicated he would just bring his phone into the time machine. In 1996, when he appeared on the show, he claimed to be 30 days away from completing his legal time.
I'm going to have to let it play a little bit longer and listen to what happened. This correlates back into an incident back in 1936.
Machine.
I think.
However, in 1997, he vanished without warning and was never heard from again, placing him at the center of one of the greatest mysteries involving time travel. Not long after his disappearance, one of the radio show's listeners called in to share an odd tale they had come upon. According to the listener, police discovered a deceased man on a California beach in the 1930s. The man had been crushed to death inside an odd metal tube, and a strange object that resembled a cell phone had been discovered next to his corpse. But Mike seemed to reappear online in 2022, refuting wild rumors that he had died after traveling to the 1930s. Furthermore, there were reports that he had been interviewed for a third time in 2015 by his local radio station. In February of that year, Mike appeared to post to a blog about paranormal activity using the username Rail Madman Markham. The user had been registered with the website since 2015. He wrote, "Rumors are a blazing that I am dead, not well, and had time traveled to 1930-something where I died on a beach in a tube. Whoever posted those pictures of a redhead is also not me. It was some school kid with my name that someone long ago attributed to me. Whatever was found in the 1930s was not me, and I've read that it was debunked, but can't find the article." In response to a question about his future intentions for a time machine, he said, "Yes, but it is stalled at the moment, until I can get some inverters. I have some 24-volt panels in my bus for a project. They got a little ratty from sitting outside for a bit." While his followers have urged him to provide proof that he is the actual Mike Madman, he has not yet provided any.
Not yet provided any, guys. A fascinating tale. The next one goes on about a guy, I think 126 or so share positives that just went straight through the Richter scale. And they got onto him and that, and he said, well, he went into the future to get all the stock market prices. Bizarre shit. It was like the odds of even doing that without one fail is just, yeah, very weird stuff. Anyway, I'll publish the whole thing. All right, let's get on to the next one. Let's see what I've got here.
Hey, and after whom? Louisiana.
I've got an interesting thing here about the states that I'll publish as well. It's about how the states come. I'll give you a taste of this. Their names, how their names come about. You'll probably enjoy this one, anyone interested.
Duke,
bit of a history
York,
lesson.
Who eventually went on to become King James II. What's the origin of York, though? Well, the Romans called the place Eboracum, inspired by an existing...
I'll post this and that last one tonight or tomorrow. Yeah. But have a listen or taste of this for about 5 minutes.
In Celtic name for the area, meaning place of the yew tree. When the Anglo-Saxons came along, they put their own little spin on Eboracum and called it Jorvorwijk, which translates as village of the boar. And then the Vikings named the place Jorvik, from which we get York. If you want to know what the Vikings might have called New York, check out the Icelandic name for the place. Homesickness is behind the name of New Hampshire, which is, of course, named for the English county of Hampshire. So the Anglo-Saxons, Hampshire was Hamtunskir, which appears to mean village, town, county. See that skir at the end? That becomes our word shire, and also gives us the start of the word sheriff. The shire reeve was a district official. New Jersey is named after the Channel Island of Jersey, and as I explained in a recent video, that's probably named after a Viking. It's thought to perhaps mean Gears Island. Oh, and here's a good one. Did you know that New Mexico was called New Mexico before Mexico was called Mexico? It is true. The Spanish came up with the name Nuevo Mexico in the 1500s, and they were naming it after a region around present-day Mexico City. Mexico, in turn, comes from this word for the area. New York, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico. What isn't new is the practice among colonists of naming the lands they come across after places they already know, even when the places they've arrived in already have long-established names that were given to them by the locals. A large proportion of this video is, of course, going to centre around Native American names, the names of more than half the states, so at the very least inspired by words from indigenous languages. But let me just tick off some more of the ones that aren't, because another practice popular among the Europeans was the rather sycophantic naming of places after their bosses back home. Georgia, for example, is named after Britain's King George II, who granted the charter for its formation in 1732. And the Carolinas are named after King Charles I. Carolina comes from the Latin form of Charles, Carolus. In fact, Carolina was very briefly called Carolana. Carolina was split into two in 1710, 61 years after Charles himself had had something very similar happen to him. Maryland is named after Charles's wife, Queen Henrietta Maria, who was a real badass, actually. She managed to avoid the same fate as her husband at the end of the English Civil War by fleeing back to her native France, but only after raising an army on Charles's behalf. She died in France in 1669.
Thanks for joining the fan club, mate. Yeah, good to see you on board, ND. Yeah, I'll go on for this for another 2 minutes. It's fascinating. I'll put the whole show up, though. Yeah, a lot. All this sort of digging where origins of words and all that come from.
During the reign of her nephew, King Louis XIV, the Sun King, Le Roi Soleil, and after whom Louisiana is named. The French actually called it La Louisiane, but that got anglicised into Louisiana. And there's one more European monarch who got a state named after them, Queen Elizabeth I. Seen as one of England's greatest ever monarchs, she saw off the Spanish Armada and oversaw a golden era for the arts. And yet, it's the fact that she was a virgin that was immortalized in the name of the state of Virginia. I'm sure she was thrilled, and I bet she's even more thrilled to know that there are now two states named after her. You know, friends of Elizabeth I claim she could speak as many as 9 languages. It's probably an exaggeration, but at the very least, we know that she was a master of French, Italian, and Latin, because we have documents and translations that she wrote. But nowadays, she could have just used Type AI. Type AI is an iOS keyboard extension app that works...
Okay, well, that's a bit of that. I'll put the whole thing up. Yeah, it's fascinating. Go through how even countries, continents, states, all sorts of things were made, you know. I wouldn't even actually mind doing a show just on my own country about all that. It'd be fascinating. I haven't done one like that.
There is a myth about Sumer's beginnings and the Nephilim of Nibiru.
Oh, well, this is the Enki one that I've put up just recently in my last show, so I won't go into that.
This Saturday and Sunday.
Now, I've done a bit about the Giants. You can go back. I'll give you a taste of the show from the Giants, man. I went for an hour and eight, I think. Went pretty long. But I'm not sure if I deleted it or if I left it on. I got a feeling I might have deleted that episode. Things went a bit south during the end, I think, unfortunately. Anyway, let's give 5 minutes of the Giants. Check this out.
Today, brace yourself for an exclusive treat. Our renowned Tartarian Giant series will be up for grabs for free on YouTube. Embark on an enthralling journey into the enigmatic realm of ancient giants and unlock the secrets of Tartaria. Act now. Click the link in our bio to seize this opportunity and binge watch all the captivating episodes. Prepare for a weekend filled with revelations and awe-inspiring discoveries. Let's revive Tartaria.
Our journey begins in remote and mystical landscapes, places untouched by time.
I can't
These untouched
back.
Realms hold the secrets of an ancient civilization intertwined.
Yeah, I can't go back and look. It's quite an extensive one. I'm pretty sure I just done it live. What I'll do, I'll rip this one as well and throw it up. Stuff it. Those three will go up next 24 hours.
With giants. Prepare to journey back in time as we unveil the enigmatic giants of Tartaria, a race of colossal beings who walked the earth alongside humanity. In a series of remarkable photographs, we'll explore their colossal presence, their enduring mystery, and their connection to a lost civilization. Why are giants almost always seen with people in these ancient photos? What was the nature of their relationship? These images provide glimpses into moments frozen in time, where giants and humans coexisted. The close proximity between the giants and people hints at a unique and symbiotic relationship. As we examine these photographs, we're left pondering the day-to-day interactions, the shared stories, and perhaps even the challenges they face together.
Hey, welcome to the show, Rick and Joe. Good to see you.
Did they engage in everyday activities side by side, sharing in the joys and struggles of life? Were these giants protectors, guardians of the past? Let's examine the evidence. In some photos, we see giants positioned as sentinels, watching over communities and sacred places. Were the giants seen as protectors, mentors, or even companions by the people they stood beside? The giants' protective roles may have extended beyond physical strength to safeguarding entire communities. Exploring this theme, we wonder about the threats they guarded against, the sacrifices they made, and the enduring legacy of their protective presence. It's a fascinating thought to consider these colossal beings, their colossal hearts filled with a deep sense of duty, shielding the vulnerable from harm. What perils lurked on the horizon that necessitated such vigilant protectors? Were they the first responders to ancient calamities, or the guardians of sacred knowledge, preserving it for future generations? Join us as we uncover their roles as builders, workers, and contributors to the great Tartaria.
Yeah, well, I'll leave that now, because if I haven't published it, I'll just publish it.
Back in 1983, David Copperfield made the actual statue.
This is how David Copperfield made the Statue of Liberty disappear.
Of Liberty vanish in front of a live studio audience and on live television. And at that time, there were no special effects like there are today. He had to make this look like it really happened. Of course, course, you can't really make the Statue of Liberty vanish. This is how he created the illusion that that statue absolutely vanished. He began by setting up a live studio audience in front of the actual Statue of Liberty. I'll use this Lego replica, which was really fun to build, by the way, to represent the Statue of Liberty. Then he had two large columns, or pillars, and they were here to support the curtain that was going to go in front of the Statue of Liberty right before it vanished. I'll use this David Copperfield History of Magic book to represent the curtain that went down in between the two columns. The perspective of the studio audience and the cameras is the view that you're seeing right now, looking at the actual Statue of Liberty. And when he put the curtain down in front, and he made some magical gestures, and he talked a bit, and he did some magical moves, when he removed that curtain, they were blown away when they saw that the statue had vanished. Now, watching this on this tiny stage doesn't seem very impressive, because it's probably pretty obvious that I just moved the statue. Clearly, he didn't pick up the Statue of Liberty and just move it behind one of the pillars. So he had to get a little more creative than that. He had the audience in this forced perspective, and instead of moving the statue, which is impossible, he was able to move the audience by taking the entire stage with the audience and shifting it just enough so that the statue would be behind one of the pillars. And to make it reappear, he just had to move that stage right back into the original position. But how could he move an entire stage with hundreds of people on it without them even noticing? First, he played very loud music with a lot of bass, so the floor was vibrating so they wouldn't notice the motion. And then he very slowly moved the platform. If you look at how much time elapsed between when the statue was going to vanish and when he actually showed it gone, it was a minute to 90 seconds to move this platform just 5 or 10 degrees. With all that loud music and excitement, the audience didn't feel a thing. Now, this trick would never have worked in 2023, but in 1983, it was a miracle.
This is another one about time travel. Yeah, this is going, I'm not sure when this recording was, about the 40s, I think. 1964, was it? Interview, okay. This one's a 1964 interview about time travel.
The man you're going to meet in a moment or two, Tassel, from Giant Rock, California, is a most unlikely person to claim to have seen flying saucers and been in touch with people from outer space. We all love to talk about the mysterious and the unknown and the flying saucers. So now it's to George Van Tassel and this question. Time machine you're building down in California.
Well, Jack, this was the result of a formula which was given to me by a man who landed a ship at my airport in 1953. And we put this formula under research, tested a number of experiments on a bench in a good electronics lab in Chicago, and we produced phenomenal results with evidence that we should do it on a larger scale in order to be able to do more with it. And this evolved out of something that started in 1953 into a four-story high machine that we're working on down there today.
Now, George, I don't care whether the machine is 4 stories high or 40 stories high or 4 inches high. When I see calmly and unexcitedly a time machine, what does your formula tell you you can do with a time machine?
Well, Jack, our formula has no time factor, which electronic formula does have. And on the other hand, electronic science has only had two dimensions to work with, the electric pattern and the magnetic pattern perpendicular to it. And we discovered a third zone, which we call a time zone, and we are working through this zone with an effort to orient the magnetic field to give us other results than our science can obtain at present.
Is that what your formula tells you you can do?
Well, Jack, this isn't a little box. This is a four-story machine focusing fields that we can orient to produce this zone big enough for a man to get into. It isn't a box.
But what happens to the man when he gets into the zone?
Well,
I'm all agog with curiosity.
Jack, we've discovered this zone is subject to thought. Now, since time doesn't record events the way we do on calendars and clocks, you could only record an event by thinking of it. Now, theoretically, we believe we can take a videotape magnetic camera into the time zone and photograph Lincoln's Gettysburg Address or Caesar's armies marching or anything that's ever happened.
All right, let me get this straight. In other words, you're telling me, like H.G. Wells imagined 50 years ago, that everything that happened in time is still there to be seen by the recreation electronically of a thought which exists.
Jack, you know how you talk into a tape on a tape recorder and play the interruptions back, identical to the play that you made. The Earth's magnetic field is the same way. You can put interruptions into it and play them back out of it. An associate of ours in creating a magnetic coupler with this principle coupled in the Earth's magnetic field and played back TV shows from stations that aren't even in business anymore.
You mean an experiment has been done to bring out of the air television programs which have been and gone?
Been and gone.
Now, where was this experiment conducted?
It was conducted in Santa Monica by an associate of mine.
Why hasn't this hit the headlines throughout the world? That's a time machine in action. If I can...
Jack, the reason it hasn't hit the world is because, as I understand it now, the Navy Department took him and the research over because he also discovered he could bounce magnetic echoes off the ionosphere and locate submarines under the ocean, regardless of where they were.
So who is this associate of yours?
This is a fellow named Charlie Arts.
Charlie Arts?
Yeah.
And is he a free man walking around today?
Well, he's free where he is in this super-secret research he's conducting.
Now, so therefore, you tell me soberly in front of the television camera that things, old television programs, have been recreated out of nothing.
Played back with a picture and the sound just as good as the day they were broadcast. We've done this many times.
Why didn't you bring one up with you?
Well, this requires quite a piece of apparatus. This magnetic coupler works on around 50,000 volts, and it doesn't have any radio frequency connected with it. And actually, the television set which plays back the picture doesn't even have an antenna connected to it.
George, you know as well as I do, and you've been on television 350 times, and I've known you. I met you once 7 years ago, and I kind of like you. But you know what the people out there are saying. They're saying this man's a nut.
Well, Jack, you know, when Fulton was running his steamboat up the Hudson River, there were people still standing on the bank saying it couldn't be done.
All right, let me take you back, though. You have a time machine plan. You have done experiments which show you can bring the past to life. Where did this formula come from?
I love that Scotch accent. Jack, the formula came from a ship that landed at my airport in 1953 on August the 24th. Which had four people aboard it that came from another planet.
I'm breathless.
Well, you're not only breathless, I was breathless.
But I'm cynical, too.
Well, that's fine. That's the way to be. In fact, I'm a bigger skeptic than you are of many things.
I'm an unbeliever. Convince me that this really happened to you.
Well, this thing is very similar to a thing that happened in our biblical records where a Lord presented Moses with a pattern to build a tabernacle. They came out of the sky, they handed him stone tablets, and this phenomena that's taking place today is as old as our history, as our civilization. This isn't anything new that's occurring. It's something that's being continued in another time of crisis when conditions affecting the people of this planet are reaching a point where somebody has to take care of the situation.
Now, I don't intend in any way to be disrespectful or blasphemous, but do you feel... And I know you're not an evangelistic type. Do you feel that you're some kind of Moses receiving a new word?
Well, I don't say that, Jack. I say that what is occurring now has occurred before. There's many records of these ships landing throughout history, clear back into Sanskrit. And there are records in the 1898 Chicago newspapers that covered the front page for 3 days of a big ship setting over Chicago. When you realize we're dealing with a type of man that is almost as far above us in intelligence as we are above the lower animals, there isn't anything phenomenal in this at all.
Now, you say casually, because this is your life's work now, ships. Now, You mean flying saucer, don't you?
Well, a flying saucer was a name the press put on this thing. And actually, what they termed a flying saucer was nothing but a scout ship from the big carriers.
But I want to go back to that night in 1953. Tell me, where did this happen for people who haven't had your talk or seen you yet?
It happened on my airport, which I've operated for the last 16 years, at Giant Rock Airport, 17 miles north of Yucca Valley in California, or 40 miles north of Palm Springs.
Now, this is a private airport for small aircraft, is it?
This is an airport used both by the military and private aircraft.
You own this airport, then?
I lease this airport from the United States government. I've operated it for 16 years since I retired from the flight test business and the aviation.
Right now, give me the details, George, because I'm never tired of hearing the details of a man who says he has seen creatures from another world.
Well, actually, Jack, this was as simple as crossing a street and getting hit by a car. After it's over, you're the victim of the circumstance. And I didn't see the ship land. One of my son-in-laws, that wasn't my son-in-law at that time, saw it come down. Another man on the airport heard it, and he wasn't where he could see it. And the man got off of the ship and approached me before I even knew there was a ship down.
Where were you then? What time of day or night was it?
It was 2 o'clock in the morning and approximately a full moon, which is like daylight on the desert.
Were you walking about outside or what?
No, I was sound asleep when he awakened me.
This man awakened you?
Well, something awakened me.
So you got up out of your bed?
I got out of my bed and went aboard the ship at his request.
This man, in what language did he converse with you?
He talked to me in the best English equivalent to Ronald Coleman.
And he met you there and he said, what did he say, come with me to my ship or what?
No, he said, I asked him what he wanted because we have a lot of people come in stuck in the sand and broken axles and whatnot. And I asked him what he wanted and he said, my name is Solgonda and I would be pleased to show you our craft.
Solgonda?
Solgonda.
Was the craft visible to you at this time?
It was when he stated this. I saw beyond him the ship, which I hadn't seen before.
What did you see?
A bell-shaped type of anti-gravity ship that they operate as a scout ship out of the big carriers.
How big?
This was 36 feet in diameter, 19 feet high.
And where was it, on the ground?
No, it was hovering 10 feet off the ground.
And how did you go into this ship?
I walked with him to a spot underneath it, and an anti-gravity beam took me up through a hole in the bottom of it.
You're telling me at 2 o'clock in the morning in Giant Rock Airport, you walked underneath this hovering ship, and whammo, you went up inside.
You didn't go whammo, you went just about as slow as a local elevator run.
And when you got off the anti-gravity elevator, what did it look like?
I was inside of a ship about 18 feet in diameter, and roughly 10 feet high to the domed ceiling, and there were 3 men on the ship. Besides the one that had got off and invited me aboard.
You keep calling them men. What do you mean, men?
Well,
little green men?
They were about 5'6". They came about to my eyebrows, and they could have walked in our clothes down any of our streets, and we wouldn't have paid any attention to them.
And did you bring any proof off that ship? Were you alone in the ship?
I was alone with the 3 men until the other fellow came up behind me, and then the 4 of them were aboard.
Were there any other earthly eyewitnesses to this?
Nothing, only outside of the ship.
And these people stayed outside?
On the airport.
And did you go anywhere in this ship?
Not to my knowledge. When I got off, it was the same place it was when I got on.
What do you mean, not to your knowledge? Had the door closed when you went in or something?
I don't know, because it was below the deck.
And did these people tell you where they came from?
They didn't say where they came from, but I've been in the air game since 1927, and their instruments were unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
Well, don't give me technicalities. What was different?
The difference was that we used dial instruments and they used vertical instruments like fluorescent tubes with marks on them.
What and color were these people?
The instruments were marked in symbols similar to hieroglyphics. They were not in any language or number system we use on the Earth.
What color were these people?
They looked like they were white people with a good healthy tan.
Did they give you any indication of how old they were, or what they ate, or where they came from at all?
After we got off the ship, the man who invited me aboard, who didn't look a day over 28 years of age, told me that he was over 700 years of age in our time.
Oh, come off it, George.
That's right.
Was this the guy who gave you the formula for the time machine?
That's the man.
And what form did the formula take? Did he implant it in your mind by telepathy, or did he give you something written in English?
He spoke it to me verbally.
And you remember this?
There's nothing to it to remember.
Will you tell me now? The formula for a time machine.
F equals 1 over T.
F equals 1 over T.
F equals 1 over T.
F being frequency. Frequency and T being time.
And this enables me to go back to the time of Caesar's armies conquering Britain.
Well, it would enable a mathematician to work this out, yes.
And why hasn't this been acclaimed like Einstein's E equals MC squared?
Well, why hasn't the fact that the United States government's been flying anti-gravity ships since 1956 been acclaimed? Or the fact that there's a crater on the moon with a base in it. Since 1954, we've known this.
Well, but let's get, first of all, the U.S. Why haven't the FBI clapped you incommunicado for breaking secrets that they want to keep secret in the United States?
Well, possibly because they know this information's going to get out eventually anyway, and what I say won't make any difference.
Now, that particular night when you had this experience, did you call the police? Did you call the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the White House?
Well, I'm 17 miles from the nearest phone, Jack, and the nearest phone would get me to the sheriff's office, and it takes them about 40 minutes to get out there.
Well, wouldn't you have a phone on an airport?
No, we have no phone.
But you're an operating airport.
Well, we're an operating airport, but we're isolated in the middle of the desert, 17 miles from the closest town, and they've never run phones out there.
So how do you communicate with people who want to use your airport?
They fly in or write, and phone to the local town where my daughter lives, and she notifies us when she comes out.
Now, you talked about a crater on the moon. Now, I thought all the moon stuff had been debunked and that nobody ever really knows what goes on the moon. What's this?
Well, this is the Gassendi Crater. This is 55 miles long and oval shaped. It's in the Mare Humorum Sea, or on the edge of it. Since 35 years ago, they wondered why this particular crater had these lines in it. And with the magnification, which you can get with a larger telescope, this is what they found. These lines are tubes laying on the surface of this crater and running under some of the mountain ridges. There are three large dome-shaped structures in here. These tubes run clear outside of the crater, and we know there are tubes laying on the surface because the sun is shining from this angle, and this mountain peak causes this shadow.
What does it all mean? Does it mean that this is a rocket launching or a flying saucer base on the moon?
This has been a base on the moon for perhaps many thousands of years, used by these people in the spaceships to resupply their ships or whatever is required.
Not even Life magazine has accepted this as genuine, or has it?
Well, the Palomar Observatory people that took the picture won't even comment on it, so...
There must be a great conspiracy of silence to keep George Van Tassel's secret of the universe away from the people.
No, it isn't to keep anything I know away from the people. It's to keep many things away from the people.
Let's talk about this picture.
This is
the time machine.
This is a picture of the machine we're building down there. This structure is actually up. We're working now on the parts on the equipment that operate it. This rim around here has armatures 57 feet in diameter, which will be better than four times bigger than the biggest armatures ever made before.
But is that the place where you did the experiments? By the way, how old were these television programs you pulled back out of time and space?
Well, the oldest one was 6 years back because television was 6 years old when this was done.
I've got an offset carrier here.
Well, plug it in. Plug it in.
Center that segment.
Centering.
Can you clean it up any more than that fish?
I'm working on it. try zooming out. I freeze.
Reverse values.
Try zooming out again. Rotate 90 degrees counterclockwise.
I don't remember what program, but I know that on checking up on some of the stations that Art found that the station no longer existed. It was out of business.
Let's get down to some more basics now. Are you making a lucrative living out of traveling around the world, evangelizing for flying saucers?
No, Jack, I'm on a vacation to rest my wife because she's been 2 years in a 40-seat restaurant without a rest. More than anything else, and I enjoy these particular things as a sideline. I make my living on the airport, and this research is something that I've got more money into than anybody else and more contribution to it. 5 years of intensive research without any pay. We donated 10 acres of land with a well worth $23,000, and we formed this corporation for the purpose of building up and investigating this basic material.
All right, now, how long is it going to take you to get your time machine in operation?
Well,
I mean, it all sounds so crazy. You must admit, I believe there are some odd things, George, but I find it hard to credit because I wasn't there myself, your own experiences.
Well, it took them around 8 years to grind the mirror for the 200-inch telescope, and the first cyclotron was something like 11 years in the progress of building.
But that cost millions, George. You haven't got millions, billions it cost.
No, we don't have the overhead, the drafts from the engineers and people sitting around the payroll. All of our effort on this is voluntary by many people in technical fields that contribute their effort to the project.
They all believe in flying saucers.
They all believe in flying saucers.
You obviously believe totally in flying saucers.
Yeah.
Because of that one, does your wife believe in flying saucers?
Well, I don't know very many people that don't. It's as obvious as believing in heaven or afterlife or anything else. You have certain things you believe in life. You believe there's air we breathe, yet you don't see it. We fly airplanes on it. And this is an intangible. We can measure it.
But why should these people come down, these from outer space, why don't they land in the White House or in Kremlin Square in Moscow and say, hey, listen to us, we can tell you a few things. We're 700 years old. We can travel through space. We're not concerned with time differentials.
Well, probably they're not concerned with giving us too much of their information because we'd only use it in our battle to destroy each other here.
Did these four men tell you that themselves?
No, they didn't tell me that, but this is a reasonable assumption on our part that the world's divided in two camps, each capable of eliminating the old civilization, and if we were to go to another planet and observe this condition, we would certainly be a little cautious about who we talk to or what we reveal.
Yeah, but you yourself, was that the only experience you had? Mind you, that's 11 years ago in 1953, John. Have you had any other contacts with people?
I've had a recent contact last September, 1963.
Well, I don't have to ask you. Tell me.
Well, in this case, they drove a car into the airport. They didn't come in a ship. They're walking among us on the earth all the time, and we don't realize it.
I'm breathless. They. How many was they?
The they in the ship was four men.
They in the car.
There was a man came in by himself in September.
Well, you'll be telling me he had Martian license plates on the car.
No. They drove a standard American Cadillac.
And what did they want with you in 1963, 10 years later?
They gave me some more information pertinent to electronic magnetic research.
But how did you know they were from some mysterious place in outer space?
You don't know unless they want you to know, and then they'll demonstrate some thing that they can do that we can't do. It's humanly impossible for us to do.
What did they demonstrate to you which convinced you, an apparently sober, sensible, balanced person who nevertheless believes in flying saucers, that convinced you they were unearthly people?
Well, they demonstrated the ability in front of 19 people sitting in a lounge, for instance, that they could sit there and disappear before your eyes and reappear. In fact, the man did this three times.
For you and your friends?
For 19 witnesses that were sitting in our lounge.
Huh. vanished in front of your eyes.
Sit right there in a chair like you're there, and then you're not there, and then you're back there. He did this three times.
Now I'm going to disappear.
Very weird stuff, guys. Very, very strange. Just makes you wonder, doesn't it? Just makes you think, what the hell is going on here? Remember Project Looking Glass? All these other little aspects of life. Well, what I'm going to do, I'm going to take the show out and leave it for this part. So you will take care, and I'll catch us all on the next episode.
My life, a vision deep.